Hello and welcome to the New Books Network for New Books in Law. I'm Siobhana Musa and I'll be your host today, speaking to Professor Sean Murphy on his new book, Litigating War, Mass Civil Injury and the Eritrea-Ethiopia Claims Commission. Dealing with a commission that was formed in the aftermath of the two-year conflict between Eritrea and Ethiopia in 1998 to 2000, this book goes to the heart and intricacies of the establishment, procedures and jurisprudence of this extraordinary commission. Pursuant to the Algiers Agreement, the commission was, through binding arbitration, given the not-so-easy task of deciding on claims for loss, damage or injury by one government against the other, and by nationals of one party against the government of the other, with issues not simply conflict-related, but also on more broader questions of international humanitarian law and international law violations. This book is certainly a comprehensive study on the Eritrea-Ethiopia Commission, to say the least, and deals with crucial issues of the Commission's life that, despite their importance, have been sorely overlooked by previous literature. And if I may take my introduction of this book one step further, it could well be, if not already, the go-to book for anyone wishing to learn about this commission and its context. So I think it's high time that I introduce the guest of our show today, Professor Sean Murphy. Professor Murphy is the Patricia Roberts Harris Research Professor of Law at George Washington University, specifically within the fields of public international law and U.S. foreign relations law. He's also a member of the United Nations International Law Commission, and before his current post at George Washington University, was legal counsellor at the US Embassy in The Hague. His career has seen him represent both the US government and several other countries in many matters before various international courts, such as the ICJ and ICTY, and in addition, he has written and published extensively on topics relating to international law. Professor Murphy, thank you for agreeing to talk about your new book with us here at the New Books Network.
Well, thank you very much, Siobhana. It's a great pleasure to be with you. And I would be remiss if I didn't note that there is also two co-authors to the book, Juan Kadani and Tom Snyder, who also were instrumental in pulling together the analysis that we're providing in the book.
Precisely. I was just about to get to that, actually, because my next question, I've briefly outlined some aspects of your very fruitful career, but of course you collaborated on with Juan Kadani and Thomas Snyder, as you've just said. So the natural course of action here would be for me to ask how exactly this book came about in relation to your career and also just the lead up to it.
Well, as you indicated, I have represented governments in various international courts and tribunals over the past 25 years or so. And as it turned out, I was approached by the government of Ethiopia to assist them with respect to these particular arbitrations before the Eritrea-Ethiopia Claims Commission. So from about 2002 until 2008, I was part of the team of lawyers helping the government of Ethiopia in bringing the claims before the commission and both preparing the written briefs and doing the oral argument. Tom Snyder, who is a counsel in private practice, was also a part of that team. And Juan Kadani, who is currently a professor of law at the University of Seattle, was a part of the team. There were other members of the Ethiopian team, but the three of us were on it throughout the process. The process ended for the governments in 2008, and then ultimately the final arbitral award came out in 2009. So we didn't proceed to write the book at that point. I myself was actually hoping that someone else might take up the task. It had been a major bilateral claims commission. There was an awful lot of very interesting issues concerning both the establishment of the commission and its procedural and substantive law. And I thought perhaps someone in 2009, 2010, 2011 would perhaps come out with, as you put it, the go-to book for the commission. When I saw that that wasn't happening, I became concerned that perhaps we might lose some of that analysis and information that really does have to be gathered up at some point, not too long after a commission finishes its work. And so I put together the idea of this book and pitched it to the publisher, Oxford University Press. They were delighted with the idea and were delighted when I brought on the two co-authors. So that's basically how it came about. And I think that we feel we did pull together all the types of information that we needed to make it a useful book. I might also note that we thought it would be useful not just to provide in-depth analysis of these issues, but also in the back half of the book to reproduce the actual arbitral awards and decisions issued by the commission so that someone interested in the tribunal could go to this book, could read the arbitral awards for themselves, and then also find within the book separately analysis of those awards with all the useful cross references so that you can go back and forth, thereby hopefully making it, as you suggested, a go-to book for anyone interested in the commission.
Thank you very much. One particular aspect of the book, which I find quite novel, is that you do place the commission in context as opposed to dealing with it as a standalone process. In that case, could you briefly outline the background of the war and what exactly led to the establishment of the commission and what you sort of state as the post-war relationship, so to speak?
Well, the war began in 1998 and went through the summer of 2000, ultimately leading to a peace agreement in December of 2000. It started as what many thought would be just a frontier conflict scenario where maybe just some troops were moving across the border and there was minimal localized engagement. Unfortunately, it got worse and worse and worse. It became a very bloody war with many lives lost, many people displaced from their homes, large amounts of property damage, much of it happening along the border between Ethiopia and Eritrea, but it also having collateral spillover effects with respect to nationals of those countries who were in the other country, perhaps miles or kilometers from the battle lines, but nevertheless affected as enemy aliens, in essence. Lots of property possessed by one side that was owned by the persons or the government of the other side. Ultimately, significant aerial bombardments took place, sanctions being imposed that blocked the ability of properties to move across borders, persons being detained in civilian internment, large numbers of military personnel taken as prisoners of war. And therefore, for about 2 years, you had a very serious, high-level armed conflict that concerned not just the two parties, but African states in the region and the African Union as a whole, and ultimately the Security Council as well, which did not take any specific action to address the situation, but did express its concern about it and call for the parties to stand down and return to their positions and situation as of May 1998 when the conflict broke out. So a very serious, large-scale armed conflict, very unfortunate that it took place, but ultimately one that was ended in the summer of 2000 with a cessation of hostilities agreement and then brought to a definitive conclusion in December of 2000 with the final peace agreement.
Okay, thank you very much. In particular, what I want to know is was the commission the only option? Were other options considered when thinking about ways to deal with loss and injury?
Yeah, I would say that there were, I'm hedging a little bit here because I was not involved in the negotiations that led to that final peace agreement. I came in to the process after the agreement was completed. My impression is that it was a complex negotiation, that the two sides each had their positions as to what it is they felt they needed to bring about a definitive peace agreement. It's not publicly known whether both sides wanted a claims commission, but presumably at least one, if not both of the governments, sought the commission because it did become Article 5 of the peace agreement. Certainly, there were prior types of ways that governments had resolved armed conflict and dealt with situations relating to claims. And no doubt the two governments were thinking about those options when they were drafting the final peace agreement. I think probably many are aware of the way wars can be ended without any attention to claim settlement processes. So one option is to simply say, we know that damage has been done, but it's either too hard or too politically problematic for us to try to address claims. When you have a large-scale war, there's typically large-scale harm that occurs. And consequently, if you do go down the claims path, it may mean very substantial findings regarding compensation. And so, you know, you're taking on a lot if you decide that is the path you want to pursue. So one option is simply not to do it at all and leave the matter to something else, some other way of addressing the matter that doesn't relate to a interstate claim settlement process. A different option is to try to quantify whatever you think the damage is, and at the time of the peace agreement, write it in to the agreement that one side or the other side owes X million dollars or euros, and leave it at that. The problem with that option is it does require you to actually quantify at a fairly early stage what you think the claims should be valued at, and that often is going to be quite problematic. So then you might start thinking about something like a claims commission or possibly an existing forum such as the International Court of Justice. In principle, there's no reason why you couldn't take a matter such as this before a court like the ICJ. I think probably the downside of doing that is that the ICJ is not well structured to handle a mass claims process. It tends to operate more in a process where it's looking at specific violations and it's going deep into the facts and circumstances of a particular violation of a particular treaty or something of that sort. Here you had thousands of individualized claims that if you litigated them out one by one, it would take years, if not decades. And so using some kind of process that could be more expedited, that could handle mass claims in a manner that would be rougher justice, but nevertheless acceptable in terms of the standards of prior claims commissions, was no doubt an attractive option. And so that is what the two countries ultimately decided to do, set up a bilateral claims commission that de novo would be created and would find a way to redress these numerous and various types of claims.
Could you possibly elaborate a little bit on what kinds of issues the commission had to deal with? What was it mandated to do? maybe you could talk about what James Crawford mentions at the start of the book when he talks about the disagreement with your approval of the Commission's decision to take jurisdiction over Ethiopia's Jus ad bellum claim. I'm also thinking of other issues with regard to the exclusion of issues not concerning Article 5 of the Algiers Agreement and the perhaps non-deliberation of pre-war and post-war governmental conduct. Could you possibly go into these issues?
Absolutely. The commission was set up pursuant to the December 2000 agreement, and as is true with all commissions, was given a jurisdiction that was not just free-ranging, but was limited to certain things. And so basically the commission was being asked to address claims relating to the armed conflict that resulted in a loss or damage to either Ethiopian and Eritrean nationals or their governments. When that loss or damage was the result of a violation of international law. So that, you know, generalized standard means that there's various things the commission could deal with and various things it could not. The claims did have to relate to the armed conflict. So as you indicated, claims that the two sides might have had prior to the armed conflict weren't within the jurisdiction of the commission. And that, of course, requires you to make a judgment as to when did the armed conflict occur. And the commission said May 1998 is when it began. It also means you can't deal with claims arising after the armed conflict has ended. The commission said that that happened in December of 2000. Of course, there's some tricky issues there where what if some kind of conduct begins prior to December 2000, but arguably there's a carryover effect to post-December 2000. Is that within the commission's jurisdiction? And so we had some issues that arose where the commission had to try to refine that sense of its temporal jurisdiction. Separate from that, you did have to show a violation of international law. So it wasn't good enough just to say this person's home was destroyed during the war. You had to show that the damage was the result of some illegal act. So in the normal course of warfare, of course, you may end up having collateral civilian harm from a lawful military operation. It's not enough to just say the house was destroyed. You have to show that it was the product of, for instance, indiscriminate shelling of civilian areas where there was no concrete military advantage being served. So, you know, that too was a limit on the way that the commission could decide these cases. As you indicated, James Crawford in the preface to the book raised an issue as to whether the commission should have decided a particular type of claim, and that is a claim relating to basically who started the war or who violated the Jus ad bellum. And one of the issues there was Article 5 of the claims agreement set up the claims commission, but there was a different article of the December 2000 agreement that called for a different kind of investigation by a panel to be set up under the auspices of the African Union into the origins of the war. That panel was never set up, and so there was never any particular finding that came out of it. But the question that was raised by Eritrea in particular was, did that possible fact-finding commission under a different article of the December 2000 agreement mean that this claims commission itself should not be looking at the facts and the law relating to the outbreak of the war. Ultimately, the Claims Commission said they felt they did have jurisdiction over a jus ad bellum claim. I think their principal point was that even if that other fact-finding commission could have been set up, it had no authority to address the jus ad bellum issue. That is, was there a violation of international law? And that the commission felt they therefore were doing something different than what that other fact-finding group might have done. So they did proceed to decide the jus ad bellum issue. I would note that one reason why I asked James Crawford to write the preface was that one concern I had about the book was the three co-authors were all persons who had represented Ethiopia. And I did not want this book in any sense to either in fact or in perception come across as a Ethiopian version of the commission and its jurisprudence. James Crawford represented Eritrea on the other side. So I very much hoped he would read the book and in the preface indicate whether he thought it was valuable. And he does in the preface. So I was very pleased to see that. I think it also was a good thing that we did not write this book immediately after the ending of the arbitral process, because, you know, after a few years, as the sort of passions of the litigator subside, it allows you to move more into a dispassionate look at the jurisprudence of the commission. And I hope that's what we've achieved.
Yeah, that actually, you preempted one of my next questions with regard to you being all on the Ethiopian side, so to speak. So I'm glad you sort of talked about that very briefly. But sticking to the jus ad bellum point, if we may, I'd like to know how exactly the commission calculated the damages for this kind of violation, and how significant is this for future tribunals when we're thinking about the jus ad bellum?
Well, I think it's potentially very significant. When you try to find international court and tribunal decisions in which a jus ad bellum claim is presented, and a finding of the violation of the jus ad bellum exists, and there's a decision relating to reparations, there's very few decisions of that nature. Oftentimes, a claim may be made and it fails. Other times a claim may succeed, but it doesn't get to the reparations phase. So Nicaragua's claim against the United States in the mid-1980s would be a good example of that. A lot of law on the merits came out of that case, but nothing on reparations, because ultimately Nicaragua withdrew the claim after relations had changed between Nicaragua and the United States. So I think in this instance with the Eritrea-Ethiopia Claims Commission, we have a very robust decision on the merits relating to a violation of the jus ad bellum, and then a very robust treatment of the reparations that should flow from that. It's a complicated story. Where Ethiopia was pressing for wide-ranging damages flowing from this violation because it was in its interests to argue for that. Eritrea, the country that had been found to violate the jus ad bellum, by contrast, was trying to minimize damages, indeed even taking a position at one point that no damages should flow from a jus ad bellum violation in this context. The commission ultimately came out somewhere in between. It did award damages. It did award compensation for the violation of the jus ad bellum, but they did so in the context of a proximate causation standard, where they attempted to limit the damages to the types of harm that flowed relatively directly from the violation of the jus ad bellum. That didn't mean only damages in the first place on the border where Eritrean forces crossed over, but it did mean that one looked at the sort of range of military activity that relatively directly flowed from the first few months of the outbreak of the armed conflict and some other aspects that could be said to be relatively closely tied to the initial violation of the jus ad bellum. And it awarded damages for that, but not for many other things that the commission thought were too remote, too speculative, or not supported by clear and detailed evidence connecting it to the violation of the jus ad bellum. So it's a fascinating part of the book, I think, and mostly appears in chapter 4 of the book. And I think that any future court or tribunal trying to wrestle with these same issues will find it very instructive to look at the jurisprudence of the Eritrea-Ethiopia Claims Commission on that issue.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that we could possibly talk about this jus ad bellum part of the commission endlessly, but I think right now it might be a good time to move on to the issue of burden of proof. I think it's quite fair to say that there was no mention of rebuttal evidence. There was, of course, the burden of proving the facts that each party relied on to support its claim or defence, but nothing on the way of rebuttal evidence. And also, from what I've discovered, no rules as to the standard of proof. Were these two elements not a much-needed gap to be filled? How did the commission deal with these gaps?
Well, we do in Chapter 3 talk about those evidentiary issues, the burden of proof, the standard of proof, the types of evidence that the commission found probative. And there were a wide variety of types of evidence. We had witness and expert testimony directly before the commission that involved questions from the government that was presenting the witness, cross-examination by the other side, and questions from the commission itself. However, you know, it's limited in the amount of witness testimony you can use because it burns up a lot of time, and it can be very effective, but it can also be fairly limited in the scope of what that type of evidence is achieving. So most of the evidence was in the form of signed declarations by victims, by government officials, by others, a lot of documentary evidence of one kind or another, some amount of evidence coming from reports by non-governmental organizations and things of that sort. So different kinds of information being provided to the commission. The commission ended up deciding that it felt that the party advancing the claim did have a burden to present clear and convincing evidence to the commission on that claim, did have to achieve a certain standard of that kind to prevail. Certainly the other side then would seek to rebut the evidence, would attempt to present its own evidence that called into question whether it was more likely or not that the claim had been established. And so there was a, you know, sort of a constant back and forth in that regard. I would say that one very difficult thing of a claims commission process of this type in terms of the typical burdens of proof and standards of proof is that when you're dealing with mass claims, you really can't litigate out the sort of individualized harm on a case-by-case basis. So what the commission had to do was to basically step back from trying to figure out, you know, were specific persons harmed in specific ways in specific places, and instead try to see if they could establish a sort of pattern of proven harms. Was it the case that you could show relatively widespread harm against civilians in a particular area of a kind that was demonstrating indiscriminate uses of force? And if so, then the commission would issue a finding that covered an entire geographic area for perhaps a particular period of time, even though the underlying evidence was only speaking to a smattering of places and persons. So in other words, the commission would have to extrapolate from a limited base of evidence a likelihood of a systematic harm occurring, and then after reaching that decision on the merits, had to move to a very complicated process in terms of compensation in doing a similar sort of rough justice approach. So I think many involved in the process felt it was unsatisfactory in many ways because, you know, it's just not a process that is closely aligned with the way we would normally like to see a particular claim dealt with in a national court, for example. But it really is the only way to do a process of this magnitude if you want to have it done in a reasonable number of years. And that was part of the charge of the December 2000 agreement, that the commission should seek to do this process in a relatively expeditious fashion.
Okay. And in relation to this, we have, of course, the civilians that suffered many types of abuses. These particular victims, of course, would require some justice. I want to sort of link this in with the idea of transparency then. Of course, the pleadings themselves were kept confidential. And I think this is a quite crucial point, especially when we think of the justice for the victims and their engagement of this. So I'm kind of more going on to the non-pecuniary elements, such as memory, forgiveness, and truth. And one quote that stands out from the book that yourself and the authors use is one by George Santayana: "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." Could you talk about these ideas further and how their relationship with the commission, with the proceedings of the commission, panned out?
Well, it's a very important issue that you're raising, and we talk about it a bit in the course of the book, and then even more so in our final chapter on the lessons learned. You're absolutely right that the written pleadings and the oral pleadings before the tribunal were never made public. So even though there were witnesses that testified and presentations as to wrongful acts that one side or the other did, none of that was made public during the proceedings or after the proceedings were concluded. The only publicly available information are the commission's own awards and decisions. That's because the parties could not agree to make the pleadings public. Certainly, if both parties had been in agreement, it would have been possible to decide to release the pleadings, but they didn't reach agreement on that, so they aren't available to be read by Ethiopians and Eritreans, let alone others. In addition, I guess I would also note that, of course, the commission itself sat in The Hague. It did not sit in the Horn of Africa, certainly didn't sit in either of the two countries at issue. So there is also a certain amount of distance from the victims in that regard as well. And it all does speak to your point of is this a good thing? I think there's probably two sides that could be expressed. One would be the one I think you were alluding to, which is that it can help in the healing process for there to be considerable transparency about these violations, allowing the victims to see that their voices were heard, that very clear arguments and evidence were presented to this commission about what they suffered, and that when the commission reached a particular finding, it's not just what the commission says in the award, but it's all the information behind that that was presented to the commission that led to that finding, that might in some sense help the victims to recover from what they've suffered, creates a historical record, hopefully dissipates some of the ill will on one side or the other. Those are all very positive values, and they may not have been served entirely through this particular process. On the other hand, I think there's another side which says high transparency during the course of the process could significantly affect the process itself. There could be much greater politics playing out in the courtroom, in the ways in which the parties speak to the tribunal, in their willingness to be candid about strengths and weaknesses of a particular claim. You know, if you're playing to a public audience, it may affect the dynamic of what can be done in a more closed environment, and in a way that's not helpful to a resolution of the claim. So for better or worse, the decision was made that this process would basically be closed except for the ultimate awards. And there's some good aspects of that, and I think there's some downsides.
So we've talked about the non-pecuniary elements. Let's talk about the money now. The commission, in a sense, pursued justice for the victims through a sort of civil redress type mechanism over the criminal prosecution. And in the end, substantial sums of money were ordered to be paid by each respective government. I think, however, one thing I should say is that in the end, actually, compensation was never paid out. But what I was going to say is that realistically speaking, if one were to look at the financial stability of the two countries in question, even before the commission was actually established, one possibly could have already predicted, given the economic status of the two countries, that they were not fit to pay out any compensation anyway. Was this actually something that was considered beforehand?
Well, since I wasn't involved in the lead up to the actual final December 2000 agreement, I don't know to what extent it was considered. If it was considered, nothing was done in the December 2000 agreement to address the issue. That is, there was no mechanism for funds to be set aside in some kind of trust account. There was no decision that, you know, particular properties might be used as a means of resolving claims. Nothing of that sort, and it's a lessons learned. If in the future the idea in the claims process is to, in fact, lead to payment of compensation, it may be that there needs to be some form of a trust account or something set up, as was done, for example, with the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal, or some kind of resource made available, as was done with the UN Compensation Commission relating to Iraq, in order to generate the funds that would be used to pay the claims. I would say, though, that while payment of the money was a key potential objective here, I tend to think of this as broken down into maybe four different elements. So one element is there's claims that a government advances and the commission says to the government, no, your claim is bad. The facts are bad, or your theory about the law is bad, and therefore your claim is going to be denied. Obviously, no compensation is being paid in that context, but it's a very useful finding because the government thereafter is precluded from continuing to say, I think I'm entitled to compensation based on the following bad acts by the other side, because the commission has definitively resolved that. A second category is when a government brings a claim and the commission says, you're right on the facts, you're right on the law, but we don't think actually the proper reparation is compensation. We think perhaps our finding is sufficient satisfaction. We think that you haven't proven that the damages actually were so bad that they merit compensation. And so there, too, no requirement of paying compensation, but it definitively addresses the claim that the government might have otherwise continued to rant and rave about in years to come. And I think that's a useful thing. The third category is the one you're raising, which is you win on the merits, you win even on obtaining some kind of compensation, but the compensation is never paid. That is what happened here. We had both sides winning very substantial amounts of compensation, almost of a nature that they net each other out. And if the two countries were able to get together and negotiate a bilateral agreement on this, perhaps it would net out in some fashion, but that hasn't been possible. The fourth thing that doesn't get talked about as much is, even in the absence of the commission deciding these claims, the mere existence of the commission has some very important effects. You alluded to one of them, the sort of recording of the history and the potential for allowing the victims to feel they've had some level of redress. I'd like to point to one other issue that happened, which is quite interesting, and that is right after the war ended, December 2000, both sides continued to hold prisoners of war. They were obligated under the Geneva Conventions to repatriate those prisoners expeditiously, but they didn't do so. They both felt they had reasons to hold on to the prisoners of war. And it's only in late 2002, as the hearing of the commission relating to prisoners of war is about to be heard, that both sides in the fall of 2002 suddenly release the prisoners of war that they're each holding. My interpretation of that is that neither side wanted to show up at the hearing arguing that the other side was violating the Third Geneva Convention while they were still back home holding prisoners of the other side in a manner that seemed clearly impermissible under international law. So this was sort of an out-of-the-courtroom effect of the commission, completely divorced from compensation, but nevertheless an enormously important thing, certainly for the persons who were being held at that time. And so I do think that while compensation hasn't actually been paid, we do want to look at the broader potential ramifications of a process of this type, because I think it does extend beyond just the payment of money.
Yes, of course. And I think throughout this interview, what you've also alluded is its general development to international law as a whole. And perhaps if you could delve into that a little bit more, what then, generally speaking, in addition to the things that you've mentioned, has it contributed to international law?
Well, when you stop and think about it, most of the litigation and decisions we're seeing these days in the context of armed conflict are all coming out of the international criminal tribunals. We have the International Criminal Court. We have the ad hoc tribunals for Rwanda and Yugoslavia. We have several sort of hybrid tribunals, Sierra Leone, Cambodia, and so on, generating important jurisprudence that's speaking about the Geneva Conventions, the Hague Regulations, Protocol 1, and so on. On the other hand, these are all criminal tribunals, so the standard for finding a criminal violation probably is higher than in a civil context, and also confined to particular things, grave breaches, for example, of the Geneva Conventions rather than violations generally of the Geneva Conventions. So I think one of the things that's fascinating about the Eritrea-Ethiopia Claims Commission is that you had, in a civil context, very wide-ranging decisions about not just things we've talked about so far, but battlefield conduct, physical and mental abuse of civilians in the context of battlefield operations, for example, looting of private and public property, destruction of that kind of property, including cultural artifacts. A very important stela was a central feature of one of the claims that Eritrea brought. Environmental damage, use of landmines, artillery shelling, displacement of civilians as a violation of the laws of war, aerial bombardment, where we have important issues as to, you know, what types of facilities can be attacked. Can you attack a airfield that has both a civilian and military dual use, for example? Can you attack a electric power station that is being used perhaps in part for military purposes, but also that serves civilian purposes? Same issue with respect to attacking a water reservoir. Lots of issues about the detention of individuals. I mentioned the prisoners of war. You know, what is it that constitutes mistreatment of POWs? How do you need to treat them when they're captured, when you're transporting them to a PW camp? Once you get them to a camp, what are the requirements for providing them with food, with medical care? Can you use them for labor? Same thing with enemy aliens held in custody. What type of treatment do you need to provide to them? Also, for enemy aliens, lots of issues concerning dual nationality. Sometimes when these armed conflicts break out, you may have the nationality of the enemy, and therefore you're an enemy alien. But what if you also have the nationality of either your own country that you're being held in or a third country? How do you handle that and think about the relevant rules of international law, the law that apply to those dual nationals? What about diplomatic relations? When you've got diplomats that are being suddenly seized at the outbreak of the armed conflict, when embassy properties are being seized and taken possession of, what is the responsibility of the state to those properties and persons when the war breaks out? And then just the broader issues of economic loss that take place. Obviously, war is a horrible state of existence between two countries in harming individuals and persons. But beyond that are the economic violations, where property damage is occurring, bank accounts are being frozen, and even more inchoate economic harm, harm to the tourism industry, harm to the ability of national airlines to engage in the types of air traffic that they would normally engage in. Bilateral trade agreements may well go by the wayside during an armed conflict. How do you handle all of those kinds of losses and injuries when an armed conflict breaks out? So I think, you know, it's an enormous panoply of types of injuries that are associated with a wide range of international law. You know, bilateral agreements, multilateral agreements, we've got law of war treaties, we've got human rights treaties, trade agreements. So I think what we tried to do in the book was to really just do a tour de table of those various types of injuries and types of international law, not so much focusing on you know, Ethiopia brought these claims, Eritrea brought these claims, but instead sort of mixing it all up and just talking generally about how the commission handled all of these types of claims, no matter which side advanced them, to try to give a sense of what future tribunals, either criminal or civil, might be thinking about in the way they approach the law on these issues.
And I think some of the issues that you have talked about now are things that we would love to continue talking to you about. Aerial bombardment, like you mentioned, the economic loss, even the denationalization claims. They're all things that your book, of course, covers, like you've just mentioned. But, however, we have taken up a lot of your time. You've certainly enlightened us on the proceedings of the commission, and I think the book is definitely something that I would recommend to read if you want to know anything about the commission. I think your unique insight, but yours and, of course, the other two authors, unique insight into the commission, having actually been there, is certainly something that gives a sort of dimension to the book that perhaps other literature doesn't have. And of course, its all-encompassing characteristic, of course, is something that stands it in good ground to be, like I said, the go-to book. So I want to thank you, Professor Murphy, for a wonderful interview. It's been a pleasure talking to you about this. I could possibly talk to you all day about it, but I hope you've enjoyed it too.
It's been a great pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity. I hope that the book is found valuable by others. Certainly, there's lots more that could be said about the commission and its achievements, and I hope others do write about it as well. But I hope this book is a useful compendium for those interested in this commission, but also in the ways that future commissions might work and future tribunals might be thinking about these issues.
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure it will be. So thank you very much and have a good day.
Thank you so much.